It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Tony Evers has issued a state of emergency for the greater Milwaukee area as record-setting rains caused historic flash flooding across southeastern Wisconsin over the weekend.
And in Door County, heavy rain and high winds downed trees in the Sister Bay area, causing some tourist attractions to close.
No deaths or injuries have been reported, but rising waters and fallen debris damaged homes, businesses, and vehicles, with two-day rain totals in the Milwaukee area reaching over a foot in some locations.
According to the We Energy's outage map, about 100 customers remain without power in southeastern Wisconsin. And that is where we start with WPR reporter Evan Casey, who covers the region and is here with an update. Evan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're in the Milwaukee area, and over the past few days, can you describe the scene for us as you've been out and about? How bad is the flooding?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. We obviously got a lot of rain just within a few hours. The National Weather Service told me they're still getting the final total numbers, but it sounds like this is the second largest rainfall event in Milwaukee area history. So obviously that rain led to a lot of flash flooding. We started getting rain late on Saturday night into Sunday morning, and I was out and about like Sunday around midnight, and I already saw flooding just within a few hours of that. Into Sunday, it just got worse and worse and worse. There was a lot of cars that got stuck in the water. Obviously the flooding led to several roads being totally just impassable. It was pretty rough here for a few hours here in the Milwaukee area.
And you spoke with Bill Haley, owner of Vendetta Coffee Bar in Wauwatosa, and that's been one of the hardest hit areas. And let's listen to what he had to say about his cafe.
Our main like cafe, as far as the bar and like the dining area, none of that is affected. But the basement itself, we have a lot of storage down there and some coolers and freezers and equipment where a lot of that stuff's been, you know, is floating in water right now. So it's probably about, last I saw, it's about like 2 feet of water down there. So, but really we can't really do anything. We can't just like go down there and pump the water out, because it's, like I said, it's literally the river is high enough that it's into the building. So we have to wait for the river to go down and to recede, and then we can start doing cleanup.
Wow, we have to wait for the river to recede before even starting to deal with this water. Will businesses, do you think, take longer to bounce back?
Yeah, definitely. In that area in Wauwatosa there's a stretch of restaurants and businesses that were all impacted. That includes like Jose's Blue Sombrero and Cafe Benelux as well. And both of them told me yesterday that they were obviously closed on Monday, and they'll probably be closed for the few days this week until the river goes back down. And then they're going to have to clean up basically before they can open back up.
Governor Evers has declared a state of emergency. What effect will that have on recovery and cleanup?
Yeah, so, you know, I actually went to a drop-off site in the city of Milwaukee yesterday just to kind of talk to people who, you know, were impacted by this. And I spoke with several people who basically their entire basement was flooded. One man told me he had water up to his chest. It took him about 5 hours to get all that water out of his basement. Another man told me he estimated damages about $15,000. And that's because he lost a lot of T-shirts that he had for his T-shirt printing business. People are reeling right now. This is a really hard time for a lot of people in the Milwaukee area. And so it sounds like Milwaukee County also had a state of emergency declared, and they have people out in the county going to areas that were hardest hit to kind of, you know, look at some of the damage and kind of see what is possibly available regarding state and federal help, you know, for this issue.
And shed some light there. Under a state of emergency, will the Milwaukee area receive assistance from FEMA and federal aid to deal with the damage? What is the protocol?
Yes, I'm not totally sure. I don't believe so. I could be wrong in that, but I'm not totally sure right now. You obviously led off with Governor Evers also declaring a state of emergency yesterday as well. We'll see. But the county did say that they have people going out and about throughout the county to kind of assess some of the damage. And so what the city is also saying is that if people do have damage in their homes, they're encouraging them to call a city hotline to report some of that damage. And another thing to note in the city is that, you know, they're also offering free bulky item pickup services throughout the entire week. And just driving around the city, you know, there's a lot of people who just have stuff on their front lawns and their porches of just stuff that they've had to throw it away. because of, damage from this storm. So that's, some of the services the city is offering right now for residents.
So as cleanup continues, Evan, what will you be watching for?
Yeah, I'm really interested to seeing these total numbers. Like I said, the National Weather Service told me they're still calculating, just to kind of see just how big the storm was. But I did talk to a meteorologist who did tell me that he believed it was still the second largest rainfall event in the city. And I'm sure we've also seen reports of over 14 inches at one location in Milwaukee. So just looking to confirm some of those numbers from the National Weather Service, because that's just a lot of rain.
Evan, thank you so much for joining us with the update.
On Saturday and Sunday.
That is WPR reporter Evan Casey, who covers Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin, and you can find a story on the Milwaukee area flooding at WPR.org. Now we turn our attention to Door County, where Saturday's storm with high winds down trees caused damage along the peninsula's main roads. Jeff Salins is the Door County Emergency Management Director. Jeb, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you give us an update on the storm that swept through Door County? What have you been seeing?
Yeah, so the storm came over Green Bay on Saturday afternoon and intensified very quickly. It hit the northern part of the county and instantly caused a lot of chaos. All of our main roads were impassable due to power lines and trees down. So emergency vehicles struggled to respond to the calls. Our dispatch center took over 700 calls in an hour, which is a record for us. We have a small community with small resources, so about 30,000 residents. But on any given weekend in the summer, we have about a quarter of a million visitors in the county. So it definitely strained all of our resources. And we had a couple high priority calls of people being stuck out at Kena Island Lighthouse. And then also at Newport State Park, which several de fire departments went out to rescue them. It took about 7 hours at each location to get those people out and back to a shelter.
Wow, what were the difficulties in getting these people out of the locations, the Kena Island, as well as the state park, Newport?
Yeah, it was really just the amount of debris on the road. We just had to cut our way through foot by foot, and imagine a 20-foot pile of trees, and you get
Wow.
through that, and there's another 20-foot pile of trees. So luckily, a contractor came in with some heavy machinery that helped us out a lot. But it was really difficult. We were just very fortunate that no one was injured in this, so we got lucky.
Is there any sense that there were tornadoes with these high winds? What have you heard there?
We definitely have a couple reports of water spouts. So there's a water spout off of Ake Harbor, Ephraim, and then another one up in Death's Door. We're looking to see if the damage from Newport State Park was possibly a tornado, just because of the sheer devastation down there. So we'll be working with the National Weather Service to investigate that further.
Jeb, Door County being on a peninsula, there's like basically very some one or two main arteries. What unique challenges does this create when responding to storms or natural disasters?
Yeah, it's a great question. All of our resources come from one direction. So we're basically an island. So we really rely on our local community to kind of rise up and help us out in these situations. And Door County is a small town community with a big heart. So when these things happen, people step up and really help out. All of our fire departments, except Sturgeon Bay, is volunteers. So we really rely on that kind of small town community to get us through these big events.
Will there be any assistance that you can receive from the state with the situation?
We're looking into that. We just got power restored yesterday evening to everyone. So now we'll be kind of digging into what costs in response and recovery were made. And start figuring that out. We're in communications with the state on what that will look like going forward, and if any of the municipalities are candidates for disaster funding.
And this is, as you mentioned, prime tourist season for Door County. How does that affect cleanup efforts and recovery and the immediacy you feel to restore the area?
Yeah, it definitely had an economic impact. I think it's too early to put a number on what that actually looks like. But some towns came up better than others. So that will be looked at, I'm sure, by the Destination Door County and other economic bureaus up here. But, you know, when these things happen, everyone has a real sense of, you know, let's get this recovery going. Because, you know, our tour season is short up here. So we need to make do with every day we got.
What are things that the community needs now along the peninsula? How can people help out?
Yeah, that's a great question. Cleanup efforts are underway currently. So we're currently just picking up all the pieces. Power is restored. So I know there's been a lot of questions on whether or not, you know, this is going to affect any on coming up vacations. Door County definitely is open for business. Kena Island and Newport State Park are still recovering. So they are closed currently, but the rest of the county is still open for business. So we encourage guests to come back up and enjoy Door County, especially with fall just around the corner.
And Jeb, before we let you go, have you seen storms of this magnitude before?
Yeah, we had a very severe ice storm this spring that knocked out power to a wide swath of the county. But this was definitely the worst summer storm we've ever had in recent memory, for sure. Just the sheer amount of destruction that made roads impassable and the emergency calls that came from it was definitely one for the record books.
Jeb, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jeb Salins, Door County Emergency Management Director, with an update on storm cleanup in the peninsula. Earlier, we spoke with WPR reporter Evan Casey about recovering from flooding and massive storms over the weekend in southeastern Wisconsin. Residents in Waukesha and Milwaukee County are encouraged to call 211 for flooding resources and to report damage.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as local media outlets disappear, a new survey finds a hunger for local news coverage.
Wisconsinites actually want a more civically responsible news. They want to see news as a civic good.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of communities have lost their local news sources.
But many people still have a hunger for reliable sources of local information.
A survey this summer from the Marquette University Law School asked people about their local news habits and whether they subscribed to local papers or followed other local media.
For Wisconsinites, the answer to those questions isn't rooted in their political leanings or even demographics like race, age, or income.
Marquette journalism professor Patrick Johnson says it's about their civic engagement and the way they value news coverage as a civic good. He wrote an article on the topic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He says there are lots of lessons for the media and the public. Patrick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let's start with this piece you wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently about civic engagement and restoring trust in local news. You start with this poll data from Marquette Law School this summer. As you dig into that data, what kind of things stood out to you about people's attitudes toward their local media?
Yeah, it was super cool because it's the first time the Marquette Law poll has actually asked this particular question. And when you look deeper into it, what you find out is it's not polarization, which tends to be what we media folks or even the national media kind of points out to, that it's Democrats trust the media, Republicans don't. It's a far right, a far left, a progressive, a MAGA movement, back and forth. And that's not what we're seeing in Wisconsin. That's not what the polling data suggests. Instead, what it suggests is Wisconsinites actually want a more civically responsible news. They want to see news as a civic good. And I think that's pretty dang cool.
Can you talk about that concept a little bit, the idea of seeing news as a civic good? This is not a new concept. It goes, I think, of people like Thomas Jefferson and others having these concepts. What do we mean by news as a civic good?
Yeah, you're right. It's not new. It is. You could go all the way back to good old Public Occurrences, the first newspaper in American history, to really see the fact that newspapers were meant to provide information to make people's lives easier, better, and more sustainable. And as we've grown, so has our information ecosystem. And what we've seen happen is the news industry has not been able to grow as quickly. And so we've slowly seen, especially with social media, this decline in this civic connection, this means of the news providing what people deem as their civic information, who to vote for, where to go to vote, what do they need to do to make their communities better, where do they need to go to donate, so on and so forth. And that's what the poll is suggesting people want and need. They don't simply just want to see, hear pundits. They want news to serve the information needs that the community wants, not what the national political ecosystem is providing them.
Before we dig more into that, I'm interested in hearing your background a little bit and what brought you into journalism and to have this perspective to tackle the issues you're tackling now.
Yeah, I am what would be called an anomaly, so to speak, a unicorn, so to speak. So I actually come from teaching K-12. I have my degrees in education and journalism. I taught high school for a while. And I left high school to get my doctorate at the University of Iowa. And I have approached questions that way, which is, again, very unique, very different. So when I think of these problems, I oftentimes think about community need, identity, education, because in large part, that is the core tenet to who I am. I think about the most vulnerable, who oftentimes are in our K-12 infrastructures. I believe the more we invest in news at a local level and those local infrastructures, the more it will improve our local economies. I mean, there's research out there that points out that local news is connected to economic growth. I think we need to really contend with this idea of teaching news and media literacy in K-12 institutions. I'm a sucker for the newspaper and education programs. And so I think those need to come back. And I think we really need to think about how do we help people understand how news serves them again, and not how they see news hurting them or harming them, which across the country in the work I do with Trusting News, that's actually what we're seeing, is that people feel harmed.
Harmed by the news. How so? I mean, I could imagine it, not just the news, but the social media feed of that news. What are we seeing as far as the harm?
What we've noticed is the more folks tune into the national news in particular, the more they assume that is a reflection of their local news. And so one of the things that we did with Trusting News is we trained journalists to do interviews with community members who were disengaged with the news. And we wanted to see if those relationships that they could build would actually increase their desire to subscribe to those local news outlets. Now, these conversations did increase the likelihood that these folks would subscribe. But what we also learned is that these folks wanted to see their grandkids' volleyball game back in the news. They wanted to see coverage of the local alderman. They wanted to know what was going on Main Street. What they were upset about is And this is across demographics, again, pointing against this almost polarized identity, this politicization identity that people kind of point to, is that they think the news points to the loudest person in the room, that every conservative becomes a caricature, every black or brown individual becomes a caricature, every LGBTQ individual becomes a caricature. And as a result, these folks, because they see national news as essentially their beacon of news, they aren't seeing local as the representation of themselves as the local really is. And so to me, that's our opportunity to say, these people want to be seen. They want to be heard.
We're talking about trust in local media, public perception of it, with Patrick Johnson, assistant professor of journalism at Marquette's Diedrich College of Communication. Patrick, I had a conversation very recently with three local newspaper leaders in Wisconsin. Want to give a listen to one of them, Chris O'Leary, general manager of the Abbotsford Tribune Phonograph, publisher of five other newspapers in central Wisconsin. She talked about her local news publication doing what you were just talking about, honestly. Let's give a listen.
We're trying to cover the things that they're not going to see anywhere else. So that's attending school board meetings. That's attending city council. That's going to village meetings. It's covering our county board meetings. Basically, the big newspapers have forgotten about. And then being at the events that are happening in our communities. They see us visibly there, taking pictures, being part of the community, volunteering. And people know who the news people are.
And Chris also mentioned those high school sports events that you were talking about earlier. Patrick, as you hear Chris talk about that role, that sounds like it exactly matches up with what you're hoping to see more of in local news.
What Chris is doing, what Abbotsford is doing, that is exactly what more news outlets need to be doing. But we do have barriers to that. And I'm sure Chris would acknowledge this. We financially need to support the news. We just saw that massive hit with public media. If we're going to see news as a civic good, as a civic need, almost as a civic service, we have to have these financial infrastructures in place so that what they're doing can be replicated in other towns, in other local papers, so that we don't have news deserts, so that people don't feel unheard or unseen, and that people do feel that the information they need is being delivered to them. And I think there's other ways that can be done, but certainly economics is something we do have to overcome if we're going to achieve the absolute good that Chris and their publication is doing.
That is a big hurdle, though. I mean, talking to Chris and some of her colleagues, they're doing these things. Their staff is spread thin often. As you mentioned, many communities have lost that local paper. They're news deserts in some ways. Doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite for public funding, at least from the federal level, for any kind of media. Do you see bright spots? Do you see models that are working to have maybe even that smaller town to have its own paper again?
I think we're seeing for sure one that is emerging, and that is the rise of a lot of these nonprofit newsrooms. We have several of them in Milwaukee, which, again, we have a different infrastructure comparatively to some of these smaller, more rural areas. So I acknowledge that. But nationwide, we're seeing this growing abundance almost of these nonprofit newsrooms who are really trying to place people in these communities so that they do feel as though they have the capacity for information to get to them. What might be controversial, but ideally my dream, and again, it's controversial because I'm going to come at this in a way that other people probably aren't going to and may get mad at me for coming at it this way. I think higher ed, and in particular journalism schools, need to get on board. And need to get on board in a way that we haven't before. Now, as an example, in Kansas, Terry Finneman runs the Eudora Times, which is a local newsroom that the University of Kansas is running. She's running as the publisher. Students are running that newsroom, and they're publishing local news content for that rural town. That's one example. My colleagues at the University of Iowa are creating an infrastructure tied to the Daily Iowan, where they're merging classroom practice with real newsroom experience to fill the gaps that a lot of the newsrooms in the area can't because of the lack of economic infrastructure. I think journalism schools, institutions of higher ed need to borrow from those kind of institutions. Ideally, I think we need to collectively work together to think about and borrow, beg, steal, whatever you want to call it, from engineering, from business, from nursing, from medicine. They have co-op programs or cooperative learning programs, meaning students take an extra semester usually, and they go work in the field. I think that's exactly what we need to do, is we need to start designing these programs where, for example, at Marquette, students take an extra semester and we work with, say, Abbotsford, and we send one of our journalism students up there, and in collaboration with us and them, that student is there for a semester to get that on-the-ground experience to learn what does it mean to impact a community, to engage with a community, and hopefully we inspire the future to invest in a way that maybe they haven't seen or understood before. And I know that's blissful optimism, but I think there is power in the ways in which education can really drastically change how journalism is understood, perceived, and hopefully funded.
For an existing news outlet that's maybe covering a little wider area than, you know, one town or one community, what advice do you have to be there, to have that public presence and to find out what the residents of the communities they cover want to hear from them?
I think one of the things that's really great, and it's borrowing from what's called the engagement journalism movement or the engagement journalism model, is I think the journalists can and should spend at least one day a week just in the community, where they literally sit there and they introduce themselves to the community, where they say, I'm X, I'm a reporter for Y, and I'm here to listen. What do you think is happening in your community? What do you think we're not covering? What would you like me to talk about? The data shows that over 80% of people have never actually talked to a journalist. So of course it's going to seem kind of scary when all of a sudden interviews appear and they don't understand why a certain sentence got picked out from something that they talked to them about for 30 minutes. So I think that's one option. I think the other thing that newsrooms can and should be doing that are in existing fashion is creating more public engagement events and or public education events where they look at their existing beat structure and they identify some longer form stories or some pretty significant things that are impacting their communities more holistically or maybe impacting a group very substantially. And they host a public event where they welcome the community in. But ultimately, it's to bring the community in conversation with them. Far too long, I think we've had a wall that made our industry seem very impenetrable. And I think it's okay to recognize that we too are human. And I think that's the value that people today really need, to know that I'm just like them. So let's have a conversation.
A lot of your message is for the journalism world, and I've been focusing on that. But in that piece I mentioned you wrote in the Journal Sentinel, I think you're also speaking to citizens, news consumers, people, right, out in the public. What is your advice to people on how to engage with the news and how to kind of encourage the kind of journalism that they want to see?
A couple of different things I think we could be doing. One is we have to be sustaining news diets. And I know right now, it's really hard for people. We're seeing growth in avoidance. We are seeing people clamoring for positive news, whatever they define that as being. But we have to have people engaging with that information. And in some ways, what we're seeing with news creators or those quote unquote news influencers is we're seeing people really getting that information in front of them in a different way, which is allowing people's news diets to start expanding. So I think we need to help people have consistent news diets. That's one. I think people should not be afraid to write letters to the editor, to engage with their communities. When I wrote that piece, I had legitimately 40 different emails within 2 days just from that one article the Seattle Times reran it, and I had a bunch from their area engaging with me and engaging with my argument. People should feel okay engaging in discussion and sometimes debate and deliberation and not feel as though the news is going to turn them down from that. I think the other thing is we have to want more, not only of the institution, not only of journalism, but of ourselves. And sometimes that's really hard to do. And again, I taught high school for a long time. I dealt with a lot of teenagers who were trying to find themselves. And I think journalism is in that weirdly adolescent moment. I mean, it's been around a long time, but I think we as a country are also in that moment. And so I think we collectively need to ask, what are the better angels that we're asking of ourselves and of our news? And moving forward, we have to seek that better system, one that improves the way in which we see ourselves, the way in which we see others, and in doing so, creates a more sustainable system so that we aren't seeing what we're seeing in terms of declines in avoidance and economics and so on and so forth.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That's Patrick Johnson, assistant professor of journalism at Marquette's Diedrich College of Communication. He's also a research affiliate with both Trusting News and the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Been talking about what people want to get from their local news coverage.
Coming up, it's a huge baseball streak in Wisconsin. Over 3,000 consecutive games doing play-by-play for a minor league team.
Every day is different, and I never know what I'm going to see when I get to the ballpark and start calling the games.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is an incredible streak going on in Wisconsin baseball, but it's not on the field. It's in the broadcast booth.
The Wisconsin Timber Rattlers play in the Fox Cities area. For the last 23 years, Chris Mehring has delivered the play-by-play broadcast for every single game the team has played, hitting 3,000 games in a row last month.
He's faced obstacles along the way, but the baseball broadcast must go on.
He joins us now to tell us how he's kept that streak alive and why Wisconsin minor league baseball is so important to him. Chris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
I appreciate the time, Rob.
All right, over 3,000 consecutive games. That feels like a big deal to me. Is it something you're particularly proud of, or is it just, you know, another day at work?
It feels like it's just another day at work. You know, baseball is a game that really looks at round numbers. I mean, 300 wins in a career, or 20 wins in a season, or 3,000 hits, or 500 home runs. Those are big numbers. And it was just kind of the background because it's basically just me showing up to work every day. And I am a little frazzled at how much attention it's received, you know, just a guy showing up for work every day.
Now, if you're a baseball player and you got a streak going, I think the rule is nobody talked to you about the streak. Did people talk to you as you were getting near 3,000?
No, not really. I got a couple of texts like back in June from some friends that were wondering how close I was. And I'm like, oh, nah, it's still like almost 100 games away, or it's still like 50 games away. And, you know, I didn't think anything of it. Nobody really said anything until like the week before. And then I started getting some texts. And I'm like, oh, this is getting a little weird. So, but no one's really heard it. It's not a thing that people brought up until a couple of days before it happened.
Now, the thing that stands out to me is you're not going to do this 3,000 games or even 2,000 or 1,000 games in a row unless you love what you're doing. What is it that you love about doing the play-by-play for the Timber Rattlers?
Every day is different, and I never know what I'm going to see when I get to the ballpark and start calling the games. I mean, for example, last night, the Brewers have sent their top two prospects in Jesus Mate and Luis Pena. They're both 18 years old. And Jesus Mate hit a 111-mile home run to right for his first Midwest League home run last night.
111 miles an hour?
Yes.
Wow.
Off the bat. And it was amazing. And I was actually taken aback for words, which probably is a little odd for what I do for a living. But it's stuff like that. You know, I've seen no hitters. I've seen walk-off grand slams. I've seen walk-off three-run strikeouts, which is still one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And plus, you know, there's heartbreak, too. I mean, the Rattlers lost the championship game in Game 3 last year in Lake County, and that bus ride home was bad. But I couldn't wait for the next season to start because I couldn't wait to get back behind the mic and see what was next.
Now, getting back to the streak for a moment, I'm also obviously a radio guy, and I've done stuff with pretty bad throat, right? Getting over being sick, allergy season, you name it. You must have had some times where you were on the edge of being able to communicate with human speech.
Yes, I've mentioned it to a few people, but there was a time back in 2011 where my voice was absolutely shot, and I was walking around for staff meetings with a legal pad and a Sharpie, and basically writing out my answers to people, or telling them what I needed to save my voice, and the games were kind of a whisper. And I remember TJ Mittelstadt hit a home run for the Timber Rattlers late in a ball game. And I think there's still video of it out there somewhere, of my voice just absolutely cracking while on the home run call. And the games were basically done in a low whisper, maybe along the lines of Liam Neeson in one of the Taken movies, I think is, I hope that I sounded that cool, but I probably didn't.
Now, I grew up a Detroit Tiger fan outside, you know, in southeastern Michigan. Ernie Harwell was my guy, right? The radio broadcaster. Who did you grow up with? Who were some of your legends of baseball broadcasting?
Well, obviously, Bob Uecker.
Sure,
grew up in Waterford, Wisconsin, and Bob Uecker on the radio was my summer. And I was very fortunate because, you know, the Cubs played in the afternoon, so I would listen to Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau and Jack Brickhouse on either WGN-TV or radio in the afternoon. And then you would listen to Bob Uecker and Merle Harmon at night on WTMJ. And then before you fell asleep, I literally was the kid with the transistor radio under the pillow trying to pick up like Ernie Harwell on WJR or Joe Nuxhall and Marty Brenneman on WLW in Cincinnati, or even picking up, if you were really lucky and the atmosphere was just right, you could pick up a Yankees game on WABC on a little transistor radio. And that was just magic to me, listening to all of those legends call games. You know, it was just amazing. And it was a very great time without an internet connection to be able to hear all those voices.
Well, you're at over 3,000 games now, but there was a game one. What was the road that connected you to the Timber Rattlers in the Fox Cities?
My first game with the Timber Rattlers, this starts back in high school with a friend of mine, a Tim O'Connick. He was working in the Timber Rattlers ticket office in 1998-99. My road had taken me to Superior, Wisconsin, where I was working for the campus radio station, which is WPR, for a friend, John Munson. I was calling hockey and doing some baseball for a commercial station in Duluth. And things were coming to an end in 1998. And I got a call from Tim that said, hey, maybe you might want to do this. I'm like going, not right now. And I eventually got a job with the Green Bay Gamblers of the USHL, which is a hockey team. So that left me in the summer of 99 with nothing to do. So I reached out to Tim Tim set me up with some tickets to a game, and he said, hey, why don't you come in and meet with Tim McCord, our radio guy? You think you'd like to talk to him and see what's going on? And Tim goes, hey, you know, I'm probably not going to be back in 2000. I'm moving to Minnesota with my family, but I think this job would be really good for you. So why don't you put your name in and we'll see where we're at. So I check with the gamblers to see if they're all right with me for traveling during the summer and during the baseball season. And I met with Larry Trucco, who was the general manager at the time of the Timber Rattlers. And they hired me in 2000. And fortunately, they stuck with me because the Gamblers won the Clark Cup championship that year and hosted the USA or the Junior A national tournament for hockey, which meant I was busy basically from for the first month and a half of the season without me doing the Timber Rattlers games. But everybody was really happy with how it went. And here we are 25 years later, still working with the Timber Rattlers.
Talking to Chris Mehring, play-by-play announcer and media relations director for the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers baseball team in the Fox Cities. Just got over a 3,000 consecutive game streak of calling those games. Chris, that makes me think hockey versus baseball. Seems like it's got to be very different sports to call because hockey, the action's going on all the time. And baseball, well, you're filling a lot between pitches. Compare and contrast those two jobs.
It is still it's still like a downshift. It's crazy when you go from hockey to baseball. I mean, baseball, there is a lot that happens when the play is happening. But like you say, there is a lot of downtime. But I found that the broadcasting both is it helps me because you have to keep up in hockey, but you also have to be able to tell some stories in a very short amount of time. And I'll tell you I still do some hockey for the Gamblers, just their home games for their internet video feed. So I do keep up on that, but it takes me a little while to get used to the speed when I get back into the season in late September. And sometimes when I get back in April with the Timber Rattlers, I'm going a mile a minute and need to remind myself to slow down. But both sports are amazing. The fans of both teams are great, and I'm very fortunate to work for both organizations. And the differences are huge, but then just broadcasting is broadcasting, you know, Rob.
What are some of your best memories from over those 3,000 games? You mentioned the walk-off winning strikeout. What are some other great moments?
Well, I remember in 2000, my first year, the Timber Rattlers won on a walk-off grand slam. And I thought, well, this is going to happen all the time. And then it happened again in 2001. And I'm like, going, this is great. This is going to happen at least once a year. And we have not had one since 2001. Wow. We have not had a walk-off grand slam since 2001. But, you know, the calling the championship game in 2012, the Timber Rattlers went to Fort Wayne and won a Midwest League pennant. Brent Suter, who was with the Brewers, now with the Reds, he pitched the final three innings of that game perfect and closed it out. And the Rattlers celebrated. Matt Erickson, who is currently on the Brewers coaching staff, was the manager of that team. And that is like a really big memory. But then there's other memories, too. Like I've got a chance to work with Brandon Woodruff when he has come up and done rehab assignments with the Timber Rattlers. And what a professional, what a great guy. And seeing him succeed at the big league level now after what he's gone through the last couple of years, just seeing him where he was at when he was on his way back, that's a great memory. And then just seeing players in recently like Cooper Pratt, prospect now up in Biloxi, and, you know, or see guys like I'm laughing now because I'm remembering we had a player named Darian Miller break our hit batsman record with Kurt Angle, the wrestler, in the booth. And I'm remembering the call that night. And I said, Kurt, I'm glad you're here because history has just been made. And I go, Darian Miller's just been hit for the 23rd or 24th time this season to set a record. And Kurt Angle goes, how does that happen? It's just like an Olympic gold medalist reacting like that. And then last year we had a player by the name of Luke Adams. He was a master at getting hit by pitches. He got hit by over 40 pitches last year. And he would always come up to me and ask what the record was going into it. And I would tell him, and then I'm like, hey, stop getting hit, start hitting home runs. And, but just the relationships with the players and the managers and the coaches and the fans, you know, there's a lot of big names, but then there's also some names out there that people might not remember, you know, that never made it to the big leagues. And I'm thinking right now about Omar Garcia, who made an incredible catch back in 2014. It was the top play on SportsCenter for a couple of days when they did the SportsCenter top 10. And my call on that was just, I mean, I was actually pretty proud of that one because it was great, you know, and I don't say that much about my own stuff, but just seeing plays and players come through in big moments are really special.
For people listening who don't have minor league baseball on their radar, either they're not into baseball as much or they just watch, you know, the major leagues, make a pitch to them why they might want to check it out and go to a game or two.
Affordable, friendly, affordable, family-friendly entertainment. The Timber Rattlers are based in the Fox Cities. We're 90 minutes from Milwaukee, but you're going to see guys that are going to play in the big leagues. And you're going to see him play in a great atmosphere. The Rattlers have so many different promotions. I'm hoping that everybody is aware of the Utter Tuggers identity the team has done. This year we did a frozen pizza identity. We have also done the Wisconsin Brats identity, where we change up and wear different uniforms and the whole atmosphere is just a fun night. Plus we have the world famous Bratzuka, and we have added a slide. So it's like the Miller Park slide out in left field, except this one is open for fans to go and slide down during the games. So if you have young kids and you don't think they're going to be able to pay attention for nine innings, we've got plenty of stuff to hold their attention. Plus you're going to see future major leaguers. I mean, just on the Brewers team right now, we've had Freddy Peralta, we have had Sal Frelick, Jackson Churio, a lot of those guys have come through Wisconsin either on rehabs or playing with the Timber Rattlers on their way up to help the Brewers to the best record in baseball right now.
As we wrap up, Chris, you hit this 3,000 game consecutive streak. It sounds like the streak isn't that big a deal to you. You have no plans to stop anytime soon, it sounds like.
Nope. I am all set to keep going because you never know what's next. And that's what keeps me going. Just keep one foot after the other and one game after the other. And next thing you know, it'll be 4,000, 5,000, 6,000.
Chris, thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate the time, and I hope to see everybody at the ballpark.
Chris Merrick is the play-by-play announcer and director of media relations for the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers in the Fox Cities. He's broadcast more than 3,000 straight baseball games for the team. You can hear him continue that streak by tuning into AM 1280 WNAM in the Fox Cities or stream live on the Timber Rattlers website. We talked about the floods and storms in southeastern Wisconsin and Door County earlier in the show, and we want to hear from you.
Were you hit by the floods? How do things look now in your community? What will it take to get back to normal?
Or if you've lived through a flood in the past, what is your advice for people who are dealing with that damage right now?
Email your story, your guidance to us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And if you have pictures to share, you can send them our way as well. At wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text our message line. The number there is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Avery Lee Rogers, and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.